Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Institute for Philosophy and Religion titled Kierkegaard on Doubt, Faith, and Uncertainty. Our speaker is C. Stephen Evans, University Professor of Philosophy and the Humanities at Baylor University. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Institute for Philosophy and Religion Director, David Eckel.
We're turning now to the thinker whose work stands in some ways, I think, as the locus classicus of the philosophy of faith in modern Western tradition, Soren Kierkegaard. Despite more than a century and a half separating us from the time of his death, Kierkegaard's philosophy remains some of the most challenging and original work in the Western canon. To help guide us into the work of Kierkegaard, we've invited C. Stephen Evans, University Professor of Philosophy and Humanities at Baylor University and Professorial Fellow at the Institute for Religion and Critical Inquiry at Australian Catholic University. He's published more than 100 scholarly articles, 18 single-authored books, five of them on Kierkegaard, and several edited volumes. Professor Evans also previously served as curator of the Howard and Edna Hong Kierkegaard Library at St. Olaf College and is a past president of the Society of Christian Philosophers. Tonight he'll be speaking to us on the topic of Kierkegaard on doubt, faith, and uncertainty. And I can say to you that when I spoke to him way back when about whether he would be willing to do this for us, he said, "Yes, I have always wanted to talk on that topic." So we are so eager to hear you lead us into the work of Kierkegaard. Welcome to Boston University.
So I begin with a puzzle. Quite a few times in my life, I've heard sermons in which a particular view of faith and doubt has been attributed to Kierkegaard. The view I have in mind goes something like this. The religious believer should not be worried or concerned about doubt as if doubt were a problem for faith, because doubt is not the opposite of faith. Rather, Kierkegaard tells us, or so the story goes, doubt is actually part of faith, a required ingredient in faith. Now, perhaps you find nothing puzzling about this story because it does seem to be part of the general lore that Kierkegaard thought something like this was true. However, I think it is odd because it's a view of faith and doubt that Kierkegaard clearly rejects in his text. In Philosophical Fragments, for example, most of what I'm going to say about Kierkegaard tonight comes from that book, which is attributed in its published form to a pseudonym, Johannes Climacus. We find the following claim. The conclusion of belief is no conclusion, but a resolution, and thus doubt is excluded. Climacus also tells us directly that belief is the opposite of doubt. Belief and doubt, he says, are opposite passions. But clearly, doubt cannot be an ingredient in faith if doubt and belief are opposites and exclude each other. Now, you might think that the views expressed by the pseudonym Climacus are not those of Kierkegaard himself, but that can't be correct. First, we know that Kierkegaard wrote Philosophical Fragments with the intention of publishing it under his own name rather than a pseudonym. The attribution of the book to the pseudonym was a last-minute change made after the book was already typeset. Only minimal changes were made after the authorship was changed. Second, many of the reasons for attributing a positive view of doubt to Kierkegaard also come from the writings of the Climacus pseudonym. So if there is a tension in Kierkegaard's writings on this point, it's internal to Philosophical Fragments and Concluding Unscientific Postscript. Those are the two books attributed to Johannes Climacus. So it's useless to appeal to differences between Kierkegaard and Climacus to resolve the problem. Now, one might also propose that the problem can be resolved by making a distinction between faith and belief. In the quotations above, it is doubt and belief that are said to be opposed. So if faith is something different from belief, perhaps faith, unlike belief, can incorporate doubt as an element, even if doubt and belief are opposites. Maybe faith and doubt are not opposites. But alas, such a distinction between faith and belief makes no sense from the point of view of Kierkegaard's text or from the point of view of the Danish language. The Danish language doesn't even have two words. It has only one word, the word tro, which is translated both faith and belief and also can be used as both a verb and a noun. Because of this, I'm going to be talking about faith and belief more or less interchangeably in this talk, because it's always a translator's decision when you go from Kierkegaard to English how you translate tro. I will, however, although I'm not going to in general distinguish faith and belief, I will distinguish what we might call ordinary belief or faith from the special kind of faith or belief that Kierkegaard thinks is required for Christian existence. Now, it's true that Kierkegaard thinks that Christian faith is, as I said, a special kind of belief, not just ordinary belief. But it does include all the characteristics of ordinary belief, too, because an essential part of Christian faith are beliefs about the incarnation, the appearance of what he calls the God-man in history. It does have some unique qualities because this historical object is, after all, the incarnation of God from the Christian point of view. And so there are special problems that come up that don't come up for ordinary historical beliefs. Still, however unique Christian faith is, it is still for Kierkegaard a form of belief, or at least it must incorporate belief as an element. The puzzle then as to why many people should think that Kierkegaard thinks that doubt is an element of faith rather than being its opposite must be explained differently. Here's the account I'm going to defend tonight. Kierkegaard makes a distinction many philosophers do not make. He distinguishes doubt from uncertainty. Uncertainty is described by Kierkegaard as an element in faith, or at least it's something that faith presupposes. Uncertainty is compatible with faith because uncertainty for Kierkegaard is an ineradicable part of the human condition. So if it were not compatible with faith, faith would not be compatible with the human condition. But neither doubt nor faith are identical to uncertainty. Rather, doubt and faith are opposite strategies for dealing with uncertainty. If one equates uncertainty with doubt, as many philosophers do, then it will seem plausible to hold that Kierkegaard does think that doubt is an element of faith, or at least that faith presupposes doubt. However, Kierkegaard thinks that the equation of doubt with uncertainty is seriously misleading. It's vital to distinguish the two, he thinks. So tonight I'm going to try to understand his motivation for making that distinction, and I'm going to argue that it is a distinction worth making. Now, to understand Kierkegaard's views, we have to situate it, I think, by answering some questions about belief that are important questions that are raised by contemporary philosophers. Obviously, this is a huge topic in philosophy. It figures centrally in both epistemology and in philosophy of mind, and so I'm going to be very selective. I'm going to look primarily at three questions. The first question is belief a current? Is it something that occurs at a moment and lasts for a certain period of time? Or is it a disposition, a kind of state of the person that lasts for a long time? Second, does belief come in degrees? Or is it all or nothing? Is it binary? And thirdly, to what extent is belief under our voluntary control? Do beliefs just happen to us? Or do we have some say in what beliefs we have? These questions are, I think, very closely connected. Unfortunately, my paper is much too long, so I'm really not going to read this section of the paper. Instead, I'm just going to tell you my answers to these three questions. But I assure you, if I read the whole thing, you would all be totally convinced that those answers are correct. So here are the answers. Obviously, these are all controversial questions, and lots of philosophers aren't going to buy what I'm saying about them. But first, is belief a current or dispositional? On my view, it's both. There's both an current sense of belief and a dispositional sense of belief. But I think the primary meaning is dispositional. There are occurrences of belief. We think of a proposition, and we find ourselves just thinking, oh, yeah, that's true, that's right. But by and large, we have lots of beliefs that we aren't thinking about, maybe hardly ever think about. So I think the dispositional analysis is correct. Doesn't mean we can be behaviorist about belief, because I think the disposition includes a disposition to have the occurrent sorts of mental events. So you can't just sort of get rid of the mind altogether in your analysis of belief. And actually, I have a quote here on the handout, on the quotation handout. This is from H.H. Price It's an old book on belief, but I think it's still one of the best books. And this is Price's conclusion about what belief is. And I'm going to basically go with this in this talk. Price says, "It should now be clear that if A believes that P is a dispositional statement about A, the disposition we attribute to him is a multiform disposition, which is manifested or actualized in many different ways, not only in his actions, but also in emotional states such as hope and fear, in feelings of doubt, surprise, and confidence, and finally in his inferences, both those in which a belief just spreads itself from a proposition to some of its consequences, certain or probable, and those in which the inference is a self-conscious and self-critical intellectual operation." So that's Price, and I think that's roughly the right view to take of beliefs. Second question, is belief all or nothing, or does it come in degrees? This is really a famous controversy. The idea that belief comes in degrees is by far the dominant view in contemporary philosophy, and it stems from Locke. But it's been challenged by some great thinkers, namely Cardinal Newman. Newman wrote a book called The Grammar of Assent, in which he argued that Locke was just dead wrong. And Kierkegaard sides with Newman on this point. I think the answer is, again, that there's a sense in which both views are right. Locke is certainly correct to say that some of our beliefs are held with a lot more confidence than others. Beliefs do come in different qualities. They're not all, so to speak, of the same grade. Although in the longer version of the paper, I have an extensive discussion of what degree of belief amounts to. It's not nearly as clear a notion as one might think. But one of the ways beliefs as dispositions manifest themselves is in our actions, as well as in our emotions. And since actions are binary, generally speaking, you either perform an action or you don't, beliefs, I think, inherit, if beliefs are dispositional, they inherit some of this binary character as well. So there is a sense in which Newman and Kierkegaard, I think, are right, in that if we believe a proposition, we're sort of committed to it. It's something like a commitment. Third question, do we have control over our beliefs? The answer is, we don't usually have control over our beliefs in the sense that we cannot create or extinguish them simply by deciding to do that. I can't just decide, today I'm going to start believing that the South won the Civil War. Not going to happen. Nor would I want to believe that, of course, but even though I'm a Southerner. But anyway, it's just we can't control our beliefs that way. However, I think if we look at actual human psychology, although people can't just decide to believe things and decide to stop believing things, what they actually believe is heavily influenced, heavily shaped, not just by the other beliefs they have, which is obvious, but also by what they love, hope, fear, desire. Just look at focus groups, if you doubt me here, who have viewed a presidential debate. Look at a group from Fox News and compare them with MSNBC, and you'll see what I mean by how people's beliefs are shaped by their desires and hopes and fears and things like that. So those are the three questions, and now I'm going to skip over to the next section. Before discussing Kierkegaard's view of belief and doubt, let me first say something about what is uncertainty. What am I calling uncertainty? In Philosophical Fragments, there is an interlude between chapters 4 and 5, which discusses this question in some depth. Most of the important points are not heavily argued, but I think they're plausible. The pseudonym begins by claiming that all becoming, all change that involves coming into existence, is a change from possibility to actuality. Here he follows Aristotle. Such a change must be a change, he says, in being, not in essence. Since if a possibility changes its nature, or if it changes its essence in coming into existence, it wouldn't be that thing that came into existence, but something else. The pseudonym Climacus next claims that this realm of becoming and the realm of the necessary are distinct and mutually exclusive realms of reality. What is necessarily the case, he says, must always be the case. Thus, whenever we have a case of becoming, we have contingency. It's true that we speak of the past as necessary. But Climacus says we use this language of necessity to indicate our inability to change the past. The past is like the logically necessary in that it's outside our control. However, this does not make the past logically necessary, for what is logically necessary cannot undergo any change at all. But the past must have undergone a change in order to be part of actual history. If these claims have a familiar ring to anyone conversant with the history of modern Western philosophy, that's because they are quite similar to the well-known views of David Hume, who divides propositions into relations of ideas, which he says, if true at all, are necessarily true, and are either self-evident or provable, and the other category, matters of fact, which Hume says are never self-evidently true and never demonstrable. Kierkegaard is a Humean on these points. Like Hume, he argues that truths that involve becoming are always contingently true if they're true at all. All becoming, he says, occurs freely, not necessarily. Nothing that becomes comes to be from a logical ground, but everything because of a cause. Even if one traces an event back to a cause from which that event necessarily follows, we're still in the realm of contingency, for that cause must itself be cause, and we eventually must reach some cause he thinks that is contingent, even if that cause is the Big Bang that started the whole physical process. This contingency is present in all of nature, because the natural world is the world of becoming. But contingency is doubly present in human history, because that history involves a becoming within a becoming, in the translation of Marilyn Piety of Philosophical Fragments, or a coming into existence within a coming into existence, the Hong translation. This is true because humans, although we're part of the natural world, we have the contingency that all of nature has, is we also, as part of our unique human reality, we have possibilities that we can choose to actualize or not actualize. Thus, humans as beings that have come into existence are doubly contingent. It's a contingent fact that I exist, and it's therefore doubly contingent that I have performed some particular action when I might have done something entirely different. To say that an event is contingent and not necessary is simply to say that things could have been otherwise. Since everything that is historical is contingent, Climacus affirms that when I come to know that some particular historical event has occurred, I must also recognize that it might not have occurred. Something else might have happened. The natural response to this, he says, is wonder. We wonder, why event X and not event Y? Since neither X nor Y is necessary, neither can be demonstrated or proven to have occurred. We may have evidence that X occurred rather than Y, but that evidence, given the Humean epistemology that's here assumed, never entails that X occurs. So Climacus describes this situation as one that involves uncertainty, what he calls the uncertainty of becoming. Now, what does he mean by uncertainty? I think uncertainty here is not a term for a psychological attitude primarily. It's a term for a logical description of the relationship between a proposition and evidence. To say that a proposition is uncertain is just to say that it is not entailed by the evidence that supports it. Kierkegaard thinks that this means a knower is not compelled by that evidence to believe the proposition. And people who adapt what we might call an objective, detached viewpoint may possibly also adapt a psychological attitude of detachment with respect to a proposition that is logically uncertain. An attitude, the psychological attitude, we might call doubt, because it is a kind of refusal of a commitment. Logical uncertainty, then, is part of the human condition for contingent propositions, and I'll argue later other propositions as well. It's pervasive and inescapable. Doubt is made possible by logical uncertainty, but it's not necessitated by logical uncertainty. Doubt is one possible psychological response, but faith or belief is another. Next section. If a person holds that the human condition involves uncertainty in the sense of logical uncertainty, and yet holds that we humans sometimes know things, that person is committed to what contemporary epistemologists call fallibilism. Now, fallibilism may just seem obvious to you because we know that we're fallible creatures. But it's been anything but obvious in the history of modern Western philosophy. Lots of philosophers have thought that knowledge required a kind of absolute certainty, something that made your beliefs incorrigible. So here's what fallibilism is. You can characterize it in different ways. Fallibilism is the doctrine that someone can know that P even though their evidence for P is logically consistent with the truth of not P. Fallibilism, thus characterized, seems to be a doctrine about the relationship between logical uncertainty and knowledge. Climacus is not so interested in knowledge. He's more interested in the relationships between logical uncertainty and belief. But there is a link to knowledge, I think, too. Now, you might hold, and some Kierkegaard scholars do hold this, that Kierkegaard thinks that knowledge and belief are mutually exclusive. I think the answer is, in some senses of knowledge, that's true, and in others, it's not. Kierkegaard realizes that there's more than one thing that we call knowledge. So in Fragments, in the Hong translation, Climacus says, belief is not a knowledge. It really doesn't read very well in English. We don't talk about a knowledge. I guess we should say a piece of knowledge. Belief is not a bit of knowledge, but an act of freedom, an expression of will. But a few pages earlier, he says that in this section, he's going to be assuming that there is such a thing as historical knowledge. And he says that historical knowledge is made possible by belief. He even describes belief as the organ or faculty by which we grasp the historical. So there is a connection between belief and knowledge, at least knowledge about in a sort of ordinary common sense way in which we talk about historical knowledge. I don't think there's any contradiction between his claim that belief is not knowledge, but an expression of will, and his later claim that knowledge about the historical is made possible by belief. It might look like those are in tension, but I don't think they really are, because he uses different terms for knowledge there. When he says belief is not knowledge, the Danish term that he uses is erkendelse, which means something like first-hand acquaintance. It's when you directly see something for yourself. And we never have historical knowledge in that sense. The historical is not something that's directly obvious to us or that we perceive. But when he says that there is such a thing as historical knowledge, he uses a term, kundskab, which is an older Danish term. It has several senses, too. But here he's clearly meaning it in the sense of a kind of a body of information that scholars have compiled. So there are people called historians, and they do say that they know some things. So there is a kind of common sense in which there is a historical knowledge. Climacus says that's true, but that this thing that they call historical knowledge, he says, is made possible by belief. So that raises the question, what does he mean by belief? How does it work? Climacus at this point makes what appears to be a digression to discuss ancient skepticism, the philosophy of ancient skepticism, but the digression has a purpose. He thinks that if we consider the skeptics carefully, we will gain a better understanding of what belief is, as well as an understanding of doubt. On the account that he gives, the ancient skeptics were not skeptical about everything. They, in fact, held that immediate sensation and immediate cognition were infallible. With respect to erkendelse, they're not skeptics about things that we directly perceive. Rather, the skeptics limited themselves to making judgments about how the world appeared to them, judgments about what was immediately present to them. But as I've already said, nothing historical is immediately present in this sense. Historical knowledge then requires belief. The historical material is uncertainty, is uncertain. Somehow we have to resolve this uncertainty. We must nullify it or overcome it. And belief is simply the human activity by which we do this. He describes belief as something that, quote, has something within it through which it constantly, in its certainty, cancels the uncertainty that corresponds to the uncertainty of becoming. Not one of Kierkegaard's maybe most clear sentences, but I hope the idea came through. So belief has a kind of certainty within it, even though what it grasps, the object of belief, is something uncertain. Now, the skeptics help us see this logical uncertainty by their example, because they are people who refuse to make this movement of belief. The skeptics doubt, and here doubt is a refusal to believe. Their doubt is not logical uncertainty, it's a certain kind of response to logical uncertainty. So logical uncertainty doesn't necessitate doubt, but it does make doubt possible. Well, you say, why did the skeptics doubt? Kierkegaard says, correctly I believe, that their doubt was motivated by the will. The skeptics doubted because they wished to gain what they called ataraxia, tranquility or peace of mind, and they thought if they could suspend judgment, quit worrying about certain kinds of questions, refuse to draw conclusions about things that they don't really know about, then they could achieve this peace of mind. They could achieve ataraxia. Ataraxia as peace of mind is consistent with logical certainty, but it's not necessitated by it. Now, those of us who are not skeptics respond to this logical uncertainty differently, but Kierkegaard thinks our stance is also willed. We aren't skeptics like they were because we don't want to be skeptics. They did. Why don't we want to be skeptics? Maybe some of you do, but assuming you don't. Either you don't want to suspend judgment, either because you don't think that suspending judgment will actually bring about peace of mind, as the skeptics did, or else maybe you don't value peace of mind as much as the skeptics did. Maybe you value other things. You like the zest of, you know, worrying, doubt, getting in there and trying to figure things out. So the answer to skepticism, according to Kierkegaard, is not to give the skeptic some sort of logical argument that proves that we know P or some other thing, because those will never work. Rather, if you want to help the skeptic, you must convert the skeptic. You must help the skeptic no longer want to be a skeptic. So the ancient skeptics help us see that logical uncertainty is part of the human condition, but that our response to it is not necessitated by that condition. We can will to become skeptics globally, or we can will to become believers. And we have the same options with respect to particular regions. We can be skeptics about some particular region of belief, or we can be believers about some particular region. Now, I don't mean to say that it's easy to do this, nor does Kierkegaard think that it's easy. It's not as if we can just turn on the belief switch and automatically become believers, or turn off the belief switch and automatically become skeptics. When Kierkegaard points to the role that the will plays in our believing lives, Kierkegaard does not mean that we have direct and immediate control over our beliefs or over our doubts. In fact, in Fear and Trembling, the pseudonym Johannes de Silencio says that the ancient skeptics saw skepticism as a lifelong, never-finished task. They never actually got there. They were always striving, but it was something you could never fully achieve. The dangers of relapsing into belief were always present. And Kierkegaard mocks the pretensions of the Danish Hegelians of his day, who claimed to have accomplished a universal doubt in the first 15 minutes of their philosophy courses each semester. Climacus here echoes other pseudonyms, humorously saying that what the Hegelians say about doubt, quote, is of such a nature that it seems rather to favor a modest doubt as to whether there really is anything to their having doubted anything. Climacus also implies how hard skepticism is when he speaks about the skeptic's use of dialectical arguments. On his account, the skeptics resort to these arguments not to provide a foundation for their skepticism. Rather, the arguments are, quote, outer fortifications designed to firm up the will of the skeptic, to help the skeptic maintain the stance that he wills to have. The skeptic does not doubt because of the arguments. He uses the arguments to fortify his will stance. So doubt is not easy. Sometimes we will to doubt, but we can't help but believing. But believing is not necessarily easy either. For belief embodies, like doubt, an understanding of logical uncertainty. So he says, when belief resolves to believe, it runs the risk of error, but yet it still wants to believe. One cannot believe in any other way. Wanting to avoid risk is like wanting to know with certainty whether one can swim before going into the water. Interestingly, he borrows that phrase from Hegel, who often uses it. So it's not surprising that faith, like doubt, is also described as another difficult lifelong task, one that one never actually arrives at or finishes. So doubt is obviously not the only possible response to logical uncertainty. Most of us are not skeptics, and we do not respond to the fact that our evidence doesn't logically entail the truth of our beliefs by suspending judgment about the beliefs. we find some way to believe, at least about some things. Belief is, in fact, just another name for the state of a person who has taken a stand by finding a way to resolve the status of a proposition that's logically uncertain. Climacus describes belief in language that is itself paradoxical. He says, when we are forming or approaching a belief, the belief is eminently disputable because it contains doubts, uncertainty. However, once belief has been achieved, he says, belief is indisputable. So belief is described as both uncertain and certain. How can this be? The answer is that belief is being described from two different perspectives. If we take an objective or detached standpoint, if we look at things from what Tom Nagel has called the view from nowhere, then the proposition that it's believed looks very uncertain indeed. It cannot be proven because its falsity is logically consistent with all the evidence. And thus a person who believes can understand how other people might not believe what that person believes. The person who believes is simply someone who has resolved the uncertainty and has made a commitment. This doesn't mean, I think, there can be no differences in the quality of the commitment. Kierkegaard does not think that people who believe something never change their minds or that believers never have doubts. Rather, I think he's making a logical point about the nature of belief itself. As Newman thought, there is something binary about belief. If I believe P, then to the degree that I believe P, I'm committed to P. The person who believes is fully conscious of the fact that a person who approaches P from a different perspective in the world may not believe P, may not share that commitment. However, if I do believe P, I am not that other person. I may find that P is true, even though I know very well there are others who don't. And I also know that I have no arguments or proofs that will compel those others to think about the matters as I do. Now, despite Kierkegaard's paradoxical description, this is not, I think, an unusual situation at all. There are many things I believe that are not believed by many of my friends and neighbors. For example, just to take one almost at random, but it happens to be relevant to our contemporary society, I'm confirmly convinced that the extreme rate of violence in the U.S. compared to other developed countries is partly attributable to the lack of restrictions on firearms in the U.S. and the resulting prevalence of firearms. However, most people in Texas, sadly, don't believe that. And I know that they don't believe that. Furthermore, I also know that I don't have any evidence or arguments that will change their minds, that will compel them to think the way I do. Thus, in one sense, I acknowledge that my belief is uncertain. I recognize it's disputable. I recognize that I don't have any evidence that proves or demonstrates it. I know there are things that my friends and neighbors who don't think the way I do will say if I try and give them these arguments. But nevertheless, I'm no less convinced that loose gun laws substantially contribute to violence in my society. Now, this doesn't mean that belief is completely unresponsive to evidence. It certainly doesn't mean people can just, quote, believe anything they want just by willing to believe. But it does mean that belief is not, with respect to matters of fact, compelled by evidence. Human beings do find ways of resolving the logical uncertainty that infects many of our truths. Those of us who are not skeptics, and Kierkegaard thinks that means everyone because he thinks no one can successfully be a complete, consistent skeptic. We're all believers, at least about some things. So doubt is an inability to believe, or perhaps in some cases an unwillingness to believe. I think, in fact, we should distinguish two kinds of doubt, though Kierkegaard doesn't really clearly do this. There is the doubt of the person who is unable to resolve some uncertainty, the doubt of indecision, but there is also the doubt that wills to remain in uncertainty. Kierkegaard says that all doubt is rooted in the will, and this may be true in some sense even for the doubt of indecision, in that the person's inability to believe may be shaped by what the person already wants and hopes and fears. But the second kind of doubt still seems willed in a stronger sense. In this doubt, one commits not to commit. One wants to remain free of the entanglements of commitment. So belief and doubt understood in this way are indeed opposites. In Climacus's words, belief is a sense for becoming. Doubt is a protest against any conclusion that goes beyond immediate sensation. Doubt responds to logical uncertainty by a refusal to commit, and belief is what enables us to make a commitment. Doubt is not then identical with uncertainty. Rather, belief and doubt are opposite strategies for responding to uncertainty. Which strategy a person adopts may not be completely under a person's immediate voluntary control, but it does, I think, reflect the person's identity, the person's self, the kind of self the person is. Whether we opt for commitment or suspension of judgment will be shaped deeply by the kinds of persons we have become and the kinds of persons we want to become. For Kierkegaard, talk about the kinds of persons we are and want to become ultimately boils down to talk about the passions. He says it is the passions that define the self. The self is defined by what the self loves, hates, fears, hopes, lots of other emotions we could talk about. Now, you might object, no, persons are defined by their actions, not by their passions. But for Kierkegaard, actions always stem from the passions. So if a person has a coherent identity at all, some kind of unified self, that must be the result of enduring passions that give both impetus for action and change while preserving continuity over time. It's not surprising, then, that Kierkegaard describes faith as well as doubt as themselves passions. This doesn't mean he has a non-doxastic or non-cognitive view of faith or that faith lacks propositional content. At all. I think there is always a content to what people believe or have faith in. But it does mean that what we believe, when we are believed, to echo again what Price said earlier that I quoted, to believe P or to have faith at P is to be disposed to act in certain ways, to have certain fears, certain hopes, and maybe also disposed to think in a certain way about P when one entertains the proposition. But as many philosophers of science would argue, having a disposition of this sort is not simply a set of counterfactual statements about how people would behave in certain circumstances. Counterfactual statements about people in this sense must be grounded in some way in some actual features of the person. And for Kierkegaard, the features that do the grounding are the passions. So if belief is, as Price says, a multiform disposition, we can ask which manifestations of beliefs are central and which are less central, which are peripheral, which are more important and which are less important. And here is where Kierkegaard, I think, differs from a lot of other philosophers. Kierkegaard thinks that purely verbal or even purely mental manifestations of belief are not so important. They're insufficient for genuine belief. A man who says he believes in God and even finds the proposition that God exists when he thinks about it has the ring of truth may still not really believe in God at all. For Kierkegaard, genuine belief in God shows itself in how we live our lives as a whole. And a belief that does not do this is not genuine belief at all. And I think Kierkegaard himself worked hard to live in this way. Here's one of my favorite quotations from Kierkegaard. He says, "It was religiously my duty that my existing as an author expressed the truth, which I had daily perceived and ascertained, that there is a God." So Kierkegaard's belief in God showed itself by the way he lived his life. Interestingly, contemporary psychologists have shown that acting on a belief, especially actions that are costly, is an excellent way to change the mental status of a belief, an excellent way to become more confident in what you believe. And Kierkegaard thought then that people who are willing to live as Christ followers, especially if this costs them something, would be the people who would be most likely to have what he calls the certainty of faith. Now, in Fragments, as I've said, the term belief is used almost as a technical term because beliefs have as their intentional object propositions that concern historical truths. On this usage, one should not even speak of belief in God, although one could properly speak of belief in the incarnation. But Kierkegaard himself does not stick to this narrow and artificial usage elsewhere in his authorship. He regularly speaks also of faith in God or believing that God exists. Even Climacus admits in his later book, Concluding Unscientific Postscript, that his usage in Fragments was too narrow. He admits that there is such a thing as Socratic faith. So there is faith about things other than the historical. So uncertainty then does not simply characterize historical beliefs. Socrates, for example, is represented as being uncertain about immortality. That Socrates believes in immortality is shown not by his mental occurrences, but by the way he faces death. So even if we expand the concept of belief to cover metaphysical beliefs and not just historical beliefs, the main point remains. Uncertainty is still part of the human condition. Belief and doubt are responses to that condition, ways of resolving the uncertainty. Now, as I promised, he does make a very important distinction between ordinary belief or faith and the special kind of faith that he calls Christian faith or belief. There are two important differences. The first is that the uncertainty that has to be resolved in order to attain Christian faith is vastly greater, because the propositional content that provides the object of this faith is the incarnation, conceived as the absolute paradox. On my reading, the incarnation for Kierkegaard is not a logical contradiction, but it's still pretty hard to believe. It's an apparent contradiction, something that is deeply mysterious to human reason, something that appears so unlikely as to be impossible. Believing in the incarnation, then, not only includes all the uncertainty of normal historical beliefs, but a qualitatively different kind of uncertainty that stems from this paradoxicality. Kierkegaard describes this qualitatively different uncertainty as meaning that the incarnation will be naturally off-putting to human reason. It poses, he says, the possibility of offense. Since prideful humans are naturally offended by a mystery that transcends human reason, and we're put off by the claim that our moral problems are ones that we cannot solve by autonomous human effort. The second difference is made necessary by this first difference, that is, the greater uncertainty of Christian belief. Human beings are unable to resolve this greater uncertainty, he says, through their own efforts. Even for ordinary belief, evidence alone is unable to resolve the uncertainty of ordinary beliefs. Passion is necessary. But the passion that is required for Christian faith, this immanent kind of faith, is not within the power of unaided humans to acquire on their own. It must be given by God himself. Kierkegaard thus affirms the traditional view that Christian faith is something made possible by God's grace. On my reading, and I've argued this in other places, Kierkegaard's view here is actually very similar to that of a philosopher not many people would associate with Kierkegaard, that of Alvin Plantinga in Plantinga's book Warranted Christian Belief. At least with respect to Christian beliefs, Kierkegaard is an externalist in his epistemology. What converts a true belief to knowledge, assuming that faith does make knowledge possible, is not evidence that's internally accessible to believer, but the fact that the process that produced the belief is a reliable, truth-conducive process. Faith is something, then, that a person must receive directly from God. It's a gift. It's also important that this process of receiving faith is personally transformative. Although faith requires, as I've already said, the possibility of offense, it doesn't require offense. In fact, offense is simply an intense form of doubt, and thus it's incompatible with faith. In his later writings, Kierkegaard increasingly emphasizes the idea that the possibility of offense is not grounded merely in the intellectual uncertainty of the incarnation, but in the requirement that belief in Christ must show itself in obedient imitation of Christ as one who's willing to suffer for the sake of the good. The believer in Christ, then, is not simply an admirer, but an imitator, one who is, in Danish, an efterfølger, literally one who follows after Christ, making Christ the pattern for one's life. The paradigm of the Christian believer is, in fact, the martyr, the witness to the truth, who's willing to die for his or her belief. Kierkegaard certainly doesn't mean that one must be a martyr to be a believer, but he does think the martyr provides what we might call the standard, what a genuine believer would be willing to do if necessary if that person were fully a person of faith. The martyr shows by her willingness to die that she is genuinely committed. Despite the uncertainty of her belief, she has the certainty of faith. And I think this would still be true even if the martyr has moments of intellectual doubt. Genuine Christian faith, then, is shown not by what one says, or even by how strongly a belief may feel true at some moment or other, but by the believer's willingness to follow Christ, whatever that may cost. Thank you.
thanks so much for that wonderful talk. I know from Troy Dujardin, who is the assistant in the Institute, that you are known for making lucid expositions of Kierkegaard's works, and we're thrilled to be able to hear an example of that from you tonight. Yes, questions?
Thanks so much. My question, it comes right as you close out here, specifically, and I'm just wanting to kind of hear your thoughts on this. Your line here, and I think you said this, the same line, is that the Christian faith is a supernatural gift, a manifestation of grace. And I'm interested that you would say that. It seems to me that part of what is going on in the postscript, at least the way that Piety reads it, is that there still has to be a volitional act for it. So we can't just purely receive that faith from God. There needs to, that's maybe engendering the condition for the possibility of faith. But without the inwardness and the passion, it could still potentially be that what she calls a pseudo-knowledge. So it's interesting to me that you think that God gives that faith. Could you speak to that?
Right. You might think, and I have students who have thought this in the past, you might think that when Kierkegaard does say, and he says this very explicitly, faith is a gift. It's something you can't do anything to achieve. It's classical Christian orthodoxy, just like Augustine and Aquinas and lots of other folks, that you'd think he would maybe go down the road of predestination or something and say, well, where's freedom? If I can't do anything. But he clearly doesn't go down that road. That's very obvious also. He talks about the desperate presumptuousness of the doctrine of predestination. So that's not where he wants to go either. So there's a problem here. On the one hand, I can't do anything to acquire faith. On the other hand, it seems as if I don't do anything, then it's got to be God sort of just doing something to me. And you're right. Postscript, fragments is an argument, a sustained argument, that faith must be a gift given directly by God, not a human achievement. That's the difference between Socrates and Christ. And then in postscript, I think the question you're raising is dealt with in 565 pages at great length. Namely, well, what can I do then? And I think the answer is, yes, there are things I can do to prepare myself for receiving the gift. The way I like to put it, this is my language, not Kierkegaard's language. He thinks that what blocks us from receiving the gift is a kind of self-confident pride. And what we have to achieve in order to gain the gift is to sort of realize our true condition. And that requires not an intellectual transformation, but a kind of passionate transformation. And so postscript is all about what kind of subjectivity, what kind of passions can I develop that will make me the sort of person who is receptive to, in a sense, receiving this truth. The first truth that God wants to give me is the truth that you can do nothing. So, but nevertheless, I have to do that. It's a bit like, I use this metaphor sometimes. Suppose I'm bankrupt. I don't have any money. I can't buy anything because I don't have any money. But what I can do maybe is declare my bankruptcy. I can recognize I don't have any money, and if somebody wants to give me some money, I'll be open to that because I know the truth about myself. And I think postscript is an exploration of how, you might say, we acquire the passions. Religiousness A is a kind of preparatio. It's a kind of preparation for the gift. But nevertheless, there's still this transformative gulf. There's this gap. There's something I can't do on my own. And that's where the gift has to be received.
Thank you. This isn't really a question. It's just a brief comment that goes to the conclusion that you gave to your fine presentation. And maybe you have further comment on it and maybe not. But it recalls for me the line of the apostle to the Gentiles, Paul, in Romans 1. I think it's Romans 1:5, to bring about the obedience of faith, which is a strange combination of words in some ways, but caught, I thought, in the spirit of your conclusion, that faith is a gift, but that there is something that Paul calls the obedience of faith, and I wonder if you had any Kierkegaardian view on that.
Yes, well, faith is, of course, as well as belief, it's also a trust. And if I have faith in you and I trust you and you ask me to do something, then perhaps I'll do it. And that would be a kind of, if you had authority, it would be obedience. We wouldn't use the word obedience normally, but and Kierkegaard does think of faith that way, as a sort of response to God, and he thinks God really does have authority. In fact, he goes so far as to say that's the real problem with modernity. We've rebelled against authority. He says the modern age is a kind of mass mutiny, and he thinks all the problems of the modern world come about from that mutiny. I would say it's not all the problems come about from that mutiny. There are other problems. But he did. I think he did identify some that truly could be understood in that way. So, but you're quite right. Kierkegaard is very Lutheran in some ways. He continually says it's all grace. You can do nothing. You know, he sounds like Luther. But then you come across the fact that he is, so far as I know, the only significant Christian author for whom the Book of James was his favorite book of the Bible. That's really surprising, isn't it? I actually just spoke in Atlanta at the AAR as part of a session on Kierkegaard's relevance to Catholic theology. And it is fascinating to see that despite his Lutheranism, Catholics do see a kindred spirit because of the emphasis on appropriation, on works, on working it all out. There's something there for everyone. So thanks for that comment.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you all for your question.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You just heard a lecture by C. Stephen Evans, University Professor of Philosophy and the Humanities at Baylor University. Professor Evans' lecture was titled Kierkegaard on Doubt, Faith, and Uncertainty, and was presented by the Boston University Institute for Philosophy and Religion. Tonight's moderator was Institute for Philosophy and Religion Director David Eckel. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Ian McCarn. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Thanks for joining us.